This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents, I Thought It Was Just Me, But It Isn't, Telling the Truth About Perfectionism, Inadequacy, and Power. Written by Brené Brown. Narrated by Lauren Fortgang.
Introduction. When people hear the word shame, they often have one of two responses. I'm not sure what you mean by shame, but I know that I don't want to talk about it. Or, oh, shame, I know it well, but I don't want to talk about it. As a shame researcher, I understand our reluctance to talk about it. Shame is so powerful that we sometimes feel shame just talking about shame. But after spending 6 years interviewing hundreds of women about their lives, here's what I've learned. We all experience shame. It is an absolutely universal emotion. The less we understand shame and how it affects our feelings, thoughts, and behaviors, the more power it exerts over our lives. However, if we can find the courage to talk about shame and the compassion to listen, we can change the way we live, love, parent, work, and build relationships. People often want to believe that shame is reserved for the unfortunate few who have survived terrible traumas. But this is not true. Shame is something we all experience. And while it feels like shame hides in our darkest corners, it actually tends to lurk in all of the familiar places, including appearance and body image, motherhood, family, parenting, money and work, mental and physical health, addiction, sex, aging, and religion. This book offers information, insight, and specific strategies for understanding shame and building shame resilience. We can never become completely resistant to shame. However, we can develop the resilience we need to recognize shame, move through it constructively, and grow from our experiences. Across the interviews, women with high levels of shame resilience shared 4 things in common. I refer to these factors as the 4 elements of shame resilience. The 4 elements of shame resilience are the heart of this book. As we learn more about shame resilience and start to put the elements into practice, we can start to move through the byproducts of shame, fear, blame, and disconnection, and move toward the courage, compassion, and connection we need to live our best, authentic lives. I've dedicated my career to studying shame and its impact on women, men, and children. In my study with women, I've had the opportunity to interview over 300 participants, of all ages, races, ethnicities, and life situations. I've also gone back and re-interviewed 60 women who have applied some of the strategies in this book to learn what strategies have been effective and what barriers they've faced. If you're not sure of shame's impact on your own life, it may help to read some quotes from my interviews. In these quotes, you can start to see the complex weaving of shame, fear, and cultural expectations. Sex is such a big issue between me and my husband. Sometimes it's great. Other times I'll start thinking about my body and how much it has changed in the past 10 years. I start to feel panicked. I imagine him judging me against these ideals I have in my head. In these moments, I lose it. I'll pick a fight or do anything to escape and get my clothes back on. One day, I was driving down the street in our neighborhood, and I stopped next to a car full of young men at a light. They were looking over and smiling. I smiled back, and even blushed a bit. Then, out of nowhere, my 15-year-old daughter, who was sitting in the back seat with her best friend, snapped, "Geez, Mom, stop looking at them. What do you think, they're flirting with you? Get real." I could barely hold the tears back. How could I have been so stupid? When I look at myself in the mirror, sometimes I'm okay, but other times I just see fat and ugly. I get totally overwhelmed, like I can barely breathe. I get sick to my stomach and disgusted. I just want to hide in the house so no one sees me. I'm 41, and I just went back to school to get my degree. Half of the time, I don't know what they're talking about. I just sit there and nod my head like an idiot. I feel like a phony, like I'm not smart enough to be there. When these feelings come over me, I want to just slip away. Really, just grab my purse, slip out the back, and never go back. My life looks pretty good on the outside. Nice husband, nice house. Cute kids, the whole package. On the inside, it's another story. If we didn't care so much about what other people think, we'd get a divorce. We barely talk to each other. Both of our kids struggle in school. We have to make these outrageous contributions to the school just to make sure they don't get kicked out. It's getting harder and harder to keep it all together. Every now and then I know my friends see glimpses of the truth. They have to. It literally makes me sick when I feel like they can see through it all. I constantly feel judged as a mother, like nothing I do is right or good enough. The worst is when other mothers put you down. One disapproving look from another mother can cut me to the core. I don't tell anyone about the things I've gone through. I don't want them to feel sorry for me or think differently about me. It's easier to keep my past to myself. Just thinking about being blamed or judged for my past causes me to lose my breath. No one knows how bad things are with my husband. They'd think less of him and less of me for staying with him. I'm constantly lying and making up stories to cover up. When I lie, I feel sneaky and ashamed. Sound familiar? For most of us, the answer is yes. Shame is universal. To varying degrees, we all know the struggle to feel comfortable with who we are in a society that puts too much importance on being perfect and fitting in. We also know the painful wave of emotion that washes over us when we feel judged or ridiculed about the way we look, our work, our parenting, how we spend our money, our families, or even the life experiences over which we had no control. And it's not always someone else putting us down or judging us. The most painful shaming experiences are often self-inflicted. The constant struggle to feel accepted and worthy is unrelenting. We put so much of our time and energy into making sure that we meet everyone's expectations and into caring about what other people think of us, that we are often left feeling angry, resentful, and fearful. Sometimes we turn these emotions inward and convince ourselves that we are bad and that maybe we deserve the rejection that we so desperately fear. Other times we lash out. We scream at our partners and children for no apparent reason, or we make a cutting comment to a friend or colleague. Either way, in the end, we are left feeling exhausted, overwhelmed, and alone. We spend an extraordinary amount of time and energy tackling the surface issues, which rarely results in meaningful, lasting change. When we dig past the surface, we find that shame is often what drives us to hate our bodies, fear rejection, stop taking risks, or hide the experiences and parts of our lives that we fear others might judge. This same dynamic applies to feeling attacked as a mother, or feeling too stupid or uneducated to voice our opinions. Until we start addressing the role shame plays, we may temporarily fix some of the surface problems, but we can't silence the old tape in our head that suddenly blares some version of something is wrong with me. For example, that imposter or phony feeling at work or school rarely has anything to do with our abilities, but has more to do with that fearful voice inside of us that scolds and asks, "Who do you think you are?" Shame forces us to put so much value on what other people think that we lose ourselves in the process of trying to meet everyone else's expectations. Shame, the silent epidemic. When you spend years studying a topic like shame, it is easy to forget how much people dislike and fear the topic. My husband constantly reminds me not to take it personally when people make the "I just smelled something bad" face after I tell them I'm a shame researcher. A couple of years ago, I had a personal experience that taught me a lot about shame and why courage and compassion are so critical to shame resilience. I was flying to Cleveland to give a lecture at Case Western Reserve University. As I settled into my window seat, a very energetic woman plunked down in the aisle seat on my row. I had seen her in the airport, chatting up a storm with other waiting passengers and airline employees. After holding up aisle traffic for the better part of 5 minutes, she got her bag stuffed under the seat in front of her, turned toward me, and introduced herself. We talked for a minute about the Houston weather before she asked, "So what do you do, and why are you going to Cleveland?" As the plane took off, I raised my voice a bit and said, "I'm a researcher, and I'm going to give a lecture at Case." "How wonderful," she responded. "What do you study?" Still fighting against the roar of the engines, I leaned toward her and said, "Women and shame." Her eyes widened, and she let out an enthusiastic, "Oh, wow." She leaned so far toward me that her entire body was perched over the empty seat between us. "Women in chains! That's so interesting! Tell me more about it!" By this time the airplane was quiet again. I smiled and said, "Not women in chains. Women and shame." "Shame?" she asked in a shocked and disappointed voice. "Yes," I replied. "I study shame and the various ways it affects women's lives." With that, the conversation was over. She averted her eyes, then told me she needed to get some rest. For 3 hours, we sat silent in our seats. Every now and then I could feel her looking at me and perusing my laptop screen out of the corner of her eye. The first couple of times, I turned toward her to smile and acknowledge her, but immediately she would pretend to be sleeping. One time she even threw in a little snore, which I knew was fake because she was wiggling her feet the entire time. When I returned to Houston, I had dinner with a colleague who is a violence researcher. I was anxious to tell my women in chains story to someone who could relate to the pitfalls of researching a less than popular topic. After we laughed about women in chains being preferable to women and shame, she confessed that most people are quite interested in her research, and she's normally the one who fakes being asleep on the plane. "I don't understand," I said. "These are both serious epidemics. Do people actually think shame is worse than violence?" She thought for a minute, then said, "Well, no. They are both serious epidemics, but shame is a silent epidemic. People understand violence and can talk about it. We're still afraid of shame. Even the word is uncomfortable. You're studying a topic that people have been taught and socialized not to discuss. It's as dangerous as violence, but we just keep pretending that it's not happening." I believe my colleague was right. Shame is a silent epidemic. It's a problem of epidemic proportions because it has an impact on all of us. What makes it silent is our inability or unwillingness to talk openly about shame and explore the ways in which it affects our individual lives, our families, our communities, and society. Our silence has actually forced shame underground, where it now permeates our personal and public lives in destructive and insidious ways. Shame was once largely misunderstood and discounted by social scientists, but now a growing number of researchers and practitioners are examining shame and its role in a wide range of mental and public health issues, including depression, anxiety disorders, addiction, eating disorders, bullying, suicide, sexual assault, and all types of violence, including family violence. Like the growing epidemic of violence, for many, shame has strangely become both a form of self-protection and a popular source of entertainment. Name-calling and character assassinations have replaced national discussions about religion, politics, and culture. We use shame as a tool to parent, teach, and discipline our children. Television shows promising cutthroat alliances, backstabbing, hostile confrontations, exclusion, and public humiliation consistently grab the top ratings. And at the same time we use shame to defend and entertain ourselves, we struggle to understand why the world feels so scary, why politics have turned into blood sport, why children are suffering higher levels of stress and anxiety, why popular culture appears to be sinking to all-time lows, and why a growing number of us feel alone and disconnected. As is the case with many epidemics, it seems that we are so mired in our own struggle to take care of ourselves and our families, we just don't see the connections that allow us to make sense of it and begin to address it as a large-scale problem. We can't see the enormity of it. We think it's a personal problem or a self-esteem issue rather than a serious social problem. To better understand the shame experience, I want you to meet Susan, Kayla, Teresa, and Sandra. I had the opportunity to interview them early in my research, and again several years later, after they had started putting the shame resilience strategies into practice. Throughout the book, their unfolding stories will serve as important examples of how powerful and sometimes difficult it can be to practice courage, compassion, and connection. Susan was in her late 20s when we met. She had been married for 3 years and had a daughter who had just celebrated her first birthday. Susan had loved her career as a physical therapist, but had spent the previous year at home with her baby. As family finances grew tighter, she had decided to return to work part-time. In our interview, she recalled the day when she thought the right job had landed in her lap. She remembered being absolutely ecstatic. Not only had she been offered a perfect part-time physical therapist position, but her church had an open slot for her daughter in their Mother's Day Out program. Anxious to share her good news, she called her older sister. Rather than congratulating Susan, her sister responded to the news by saying, "I'm not sure why you even had a child if you're not interested in raising her." Susan remembers feeling like she had been punched in the stomach. She said, "I could hardly breathe. It was devastating. My first thought was, I'm a bad mother." By that evening, I was reconsidering the job offer. When I interviewed Kayla, she was in her mid-40s and had built a successful career in advertising. She lived alone in a large city on the East Coast. Kayla's father had recently been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and she was struggling to balance the pressures of her career with her new role as her father's primary caregiver. She explained that the most difficult issue was dealing with her boss, Nancy. Kayla described Nancy as the kind of person you never share personal information with. When I asked her to explain what she meant, she said that Nancy had perfected the art of the personal attack. The more Nancy knew about your life, the more ammunition she had for her arsenal. When Kayla's mother died 2 years prior, Kayla struggled with depression. She had confided in Nancy about the depression, only to have Nancy bring it up in front of other colleagues. Kayla said that, despite her fear of Nancy's attacks, she knew she might miss some work while she looked for a long-term care facility, so she explained her father's situation to Nancy. Kayla still looked shocked as she described the very first staff meeting she attended after she told her boss. During the meeting, Nancy announced that Kayla was going to be pulled off her current project. Kayla said, "She looked right at me and said to the group, 'You know, Kayla, there's always some kind of drama.'" Kayla describes that moment as pure paralysis. I froze. I felt so small and sliced open. Was Nancy right? Am I a flake? How could I have been so stupid to trust Nancy? When I met Teresa, she was 35 and had 3 children, ranging from age 3 to 11. She described an experience that probably lasted no more than 5 minutes, but for her represented one of her greatest struggles. She remembered standing in front of her mirror and feeling extreme anxiety and hatred about her body. She said, "It was one of those days when nothing fit. I had tried on every pair of jeans that I could find." She said she found herself grabbing at the inside of her thighs and pinching the fat that hung over the side of her bra and chanting, "This is disgusting. I'm disgusting." She said the entire episode was more stressful because she could hear her kids fighting over the television in the other room while the phone rang off the hook. She started screaming at her kids, "Will someone get the damn phone? I know I'm not the only one who hears it, damn it!" She finally buried her head in her hands and started sobbing. When she raised her head up, she saw her toddler standing a few feet away. He told her in a frightened voice, "I'm sorry, Mommy's sad." As she stared at him, she was flooded with feelings of shame and self-blame. Teresa told me she would never forget that day and explained, "Sometimes I just get sick of it all. My body, my kids, my house, my entire life. I have these pictures in my head of what I want everything to look like. And it's never that perfect. I just can't ever pull it all together. On top of it, I feel so ashamed when I take it out on my kids." Sandra, a high school teacher in her mid-50s, seemed both angry and sad when she told me, "I used to love to debate politics with my brother-in-law. We did it for years. One night when my husband and I were driving home from Sunday dinner, he told me that he hated when I argued with his brother. He told me he had always hated it. He said, "Donald is a smart guy. He's got a master's degree. I wish you wouldn't get into it with him." Then he told me that I sounded uneducated and stupid, and it made him look bad. I became totally withdrawn around his family. Are Susan, Kayla, Teresa, and Sandra simply struggling from low self-esteem? No. Shame and self-esteem are very different issues. We feel shame. We think self-esteem. Our self-esteem is based on how we see ourselves, our strengths and limitations, over time. It is how and what we think of ourselves. Shame is an emotion. It is how we feel when we have certain experiences. When we are in shame, we don't see the big picture. We don't accurately think about our strengths and limitations. We just feel alone, exposed and deeply flawed. My friend and colleague, Marian Mankin, described the difference between shame and self-esteem this way. When I think about my self-esteem, I think about who I am in relation to who I want to be, where I come from, what I've overcome, and what I've accomplished. When I feel shame, I'm taken back to this place of smallness where I lose that sense of contact. I'm returned to a small place. I can't see everything else. It's just a small, lonely place. If these stories aren't about self-esteem, could they simply be about the company we keep? Does Susan just have a mean sister? Is Kayla simply the victim of an insensitive remark? Is Teresa's struggle with perfection an isolated case? Is Sandra's husband the only problem? The answer to all these questions is no. If you look at all four of the examples concerning motherhood, work, perfectionism, and speaking out, you'll see that shame is the primary weapon used in these cultural wars. We are constantly threatening mothers with the shame of not doing what's best for their children, or making selfish or ignorant choices. Similarly, Kayla's experience points to the shame culture that has taken over many workplaces. We are expected to produce and keep our professional and personal lives artificially compartmentalized in order to succeed. Her boss's comment is a product of that culture. Although we're told and want to believe, you are not your job. The messages from employers, colleagues, and the media counter that well-intentioned adage with, you are exactly what you do, how well you do it, and what you earn. When it comes to Teresa's struggle, we need to understand that shame is the voice of perfectionism. Whether we're talking about appearance, work, motherhood, health, or family, it's not the quest for perfection that is so painful. It's failing to meet the unattainable expectations that lead to the painful wash of shame. Last, Sandra's story speaks to the power of shame as a social tool that's often used to keep us quiet. Nothing silences us more effectively than shame. As you can see, shame is much more than insensitive communicating or a self-esteem issue. It is a basic human experience that is becoming an increasingly divisive and destructive part of our culture. During certain times and in certain situations, we all struggle with feelings of not being good enough, not having enough, and not belonging enough. I have found that the most effective way to overcome these feelings of inadequacy is to share our experiences. Of course, in this culture, telling our stories takes courage. Courage, compassion, and connection. Courage is a heart word. The root of the word courage is cor, the Latin word for heart. In one of its earliest forms, the word courage meant to speak one's mind by telling all one's heart. Over time, this definition has changed, and today we typically associate courage with heroic and brave deeds. But in my opinion, this definition fails to recognize the inner strength and level of commitment required for us to actually speak honestly and openly about who we are and about our experiences, good and bad. Speaking from our hearts is what I think of as ordinary courage. I'm not sure where the term ordinary courage first appeared, but I discovered it in an article on women and girls by researcher Annie Rogers. I think the idea of ordinary courage speaks to the importance of telling our stories. It is especially difficult to practice ordinary courage in today's culture of shame, a culture full of fear, blame, and disconnection. However, practicing the strategies in this book will help all of us reclaim our courage and power, and even start to change the culture. To understand how shame is influenced by culture, we need to think back to when we were children or young adults, and we first learned how important it is to be liked, to fit in, and to please others. The lessons were often taught by shame, sometimes overtly, other times covertly. Regardless of how they happened, we can all recall experiences of feeling rejected, diminished, and ridiculed. Eventually, we learned to fear these feelings. We learned how to change our behaviors, thinking and feeling to avoid feeling shame. In the process, we changed who we were and, in many instances, who we are now. Our culture teaches us about shame. It dictates what is acceptable and what is not. We weren't born craving perfect bodies. We weren't born afraid to tell our stories. We weren't born with a fear of getting too old to feel valuable. We weren't born with a Pottery Barn catalog in one hand and heartbreaking debt in the other. Shame comes from outside of us, from the messages and expectations of our culture. What comes from the inside of us is a very human need to belong, to relate. We are wired for connection. It's in our biology. As infants, our need for connection is about survival. As we grow older, connection means thriving emotionally, physically, spiritually, and intellectually. Connection is critical because we all have the basic need to feel accepted and to believe that we belong and are valued for who we are. Shame unravels our connection to others. In fact, I often refer to shame as the fear of disconnection, the fear of being perceived as flawed and unworthy of acceptance or belonging. Shame keeps us from telling our own stories and prevents us from listening to others tell their stories. We silence our voices and keep our secrets out of the fear of disconnection. When we hear others talk about their shame, we often blame them as a way to protect ourselves from feeling uncomfortable. Hearing someone talk about a shameful experience can sometimes be as painful as actually experiencing it for ourselves. Like courage, empathy and compassion are critical components of shame resilience. Practicing compassion allows us to hear shame. Empathy, the most powerful tool of compassion, is an emotional skill that allows us to respond to others in a meaningful, caring way. Empathy is the ability to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, to understand what someone is experiencing, and to reflect back that understanding. When we share a difficult experience with someone, and that person responds in an open, deeply connected way, that's empathy. Developing empathy can enrich the relationships we have with our partners, colleagues, family members, and children. In Chapter 2, I'll discuss the concept of empathy in great detail. You'll learn how it works, how we can learn to be empathetic, and why the opposite of experiencing shame is experiencing empathy. The prerequisite for empathy is compassion. We can only respond empathetically if we are willing to hear someone's pain. We sometimes think of compassion as a saint-like virtue. It's not. In fact, compassion is possible for anyone who can accept the struggles that make us human. Our fears, imperfections, losses, and shame. We can only respond compassionately to someone telling her story if we have embraced our own story, shame and all. Compassion is not a virtue. It is a commitment. It's not something we have or don't have. It's something we choose to practice. Can we be with someone who is in shame and open ourselves up enough to listen to her story and share her pain? An overview of the book. This book is divided into 11 chapters, including this introduction. In Chapter 1, I'll share stories and examples in order to build a definition of shame and differentiate shame from other emotions like guilt, humiliation, and embarrassment. In Chapter 2, we'll explore the basics of resilience, empathy, courage, compassion, and connection. Chapters 3 to 6 will focus on the four elements of shame resilience, In my research, I found that women with high levels of shame resilience had four things in common. When practiced together, these four elements move us toward resilience. In each of these four chapters, I'll share specific strategies that we can use to help us develop shame resilience and information on how we can overcome some of the common barriers women face as they begin to put these strategies into practice. The culture of shame is driven by fear, blame, and disconnection, and it is often a powerful incubator for issues like perfectionism, stereotyping, gossiping, and addiction. In chapters 7 to 9, I'll explore these issues and others in the context of developing and maintaining our shame resilience. The final chapter will present ideas for actually changing the culture. What does shame resilience mean for our children, the men in our lives, our spiritual lives, our workplaces, and our families? Shame is a difficult topic. However, as painful as some of the stories may be, the raw honesty of their truths confirms that the information and ideas in this book are tremendous sources of hope and promise for women. I believe that we are all capable of developing resilience to shame. We are all capable of turning the pain caused by shame into courage, compassion, and connection. Equally important, we are all capable of helping others do the same. However, it is vitally important to recognize the complexity of this work. This is not four easy steps to shame resilience or some other simple recipe for overcoming shame. Cookbook answers don't work when it comes to addressing an issue like shame, or for that matter, any other complex human issue. In fact, it can even be shaming when we believe that there are easy remedies for complicated problems. We tend to blame ourselves for not being able to get it. It has been said that real freedom is about setting others free. In the spirit of that powerful definition, my greatest hope is that we will reach out across our differences and through our shame to share our stories and to connect with those who need to hear you are not alone. 1. Understanding shame. When people ask me how I became a shame researcher, I tell them that my career was built around one sentence. You cannot shame or belittle people into changing their behaviors. When I was in my 20s, I worked in a residential treatment facility for children. One day during a staff meeting, the clinical director who oversees the therapeutic work done with the children spoke to us about helping the kids make better choices. He said, "I know you want to help these kids. But you must understand this. You cannot shame or belittle people into changing their behaviors." He went on to explain that regardless of our intentions, we can't force people to make positive changes by putting them down, threatening them with rejection, humiliating them in front of others, or belittling them. From the moment the words were spoken, I was absolutely overwhelmed by this idea. For weeks, I thought of little else. Yet no matter how long and hard I thought about it, or how many times I repeated the statement out loud, I couldn't get my head around it. There were minutes when I thought it was, at best, pie in the sky, wishful thinking. And then there were brief seconds when I believed it was the truest thing I'd ever heard. But despite my confusion, I recognized that there was something incredibly important about understanding shame. As it turned out, I spent the next 10 years of my life researching shame and its impact on our lives. I eventually left my job at the residential treatment facility to attend graduate school. Over the next 7 years, I earned master's and doctoral degrees in social work. My entire education was driven by that powerful proposition: you cannot shame or belittle people into changing their behaviors. I wanted to understand how and why we use shame. I also wanted to understand the consequences of attempting to use shame to change people. It's not that I publicly studied shame. I just listened, learned, and tested every piece of new information against that proposition. Here's what I have learned. Can you use shame or humiliation to change people or behavior? Yes and no. Yes, you can try. In fact, if you really zero in on an exposed vulnerability, you could actually see a very swift behavior change. Will the change last? No. Will it hurt? Yes, it's excruciating. Will it do any damage? Yes, it has the potential to scar both the person using shame and the person being shamed. Is shame used very often as a way to change people? Yes, every minute of every day. I also learned that most of us, if not all, have built significant parts of our lives around shame. Individuals, families, and communities use shame as a tool to change others and to protect themselves. In doing this, we create a society that fails to recognize how much damage shame does to our spirit and to the soul of our families and our communities. One reason we don't see the connections between our personal struggles and larger cultural issues goes back to the silent part of silent epidemic. We do not talk about shame. We experience it. We feel it. We sometimes live with it for an entire lifetime, but we don't talk about it. When was the last time you had a meaningful conversation about shame? If you're like most people, the answer is never. Despite our society's relatively new openness to discussing other emotions like fear and anger, shame remains taboo. I think it's important to understand that it's not just plain folk who avoid the topic of shame. It's also mental health professionals, researchers, physicians, and other professionals who are often the ones we depend on to identify and spark the first discussions about social epidemics. After I completed the first component of my research, I spent several months traveling across the nation, presenting my work to helping professionals. For many of them, even those who had been in medical or psychotherapy practices for decades, it was their first time attending a workshop on shame. On their feedback forms, many of the participants wrote that it was one of the most personally difficult workshops they had attended. And for many of the attendees, it was their first exposure to shame research. Unlike many of the other topics that professionals study, there is no us and them when it comes to shame. As professionals, we don't have the luxury of thinking, "Let me learn about this topic that affects my patients so I can help them." Shame is universal. No one is exempt. If we can't talk about shame and examine the impact it has on our own lives, we certainly can't be helpful to others. Of course, there are some researchers and practitioners doing very important work on women and shame. June Tangney and Rhonda Deering, researchers and clinicians at the Stone Center at Wellesley. Harriet Lerner and Claudia Black, to name just a few. However, it's been my experience that the topic remains as silenced in the mental health community as it is in the community at large. This professional silence is important to understand because there are studies that identify shame as the dominant emotion experienced by mental health clients, exceeding anger, fear, grief, and anxiety. So, if the mental and public health communities aren't talking about shame, or providing enough safe spaces for people to get help with shame issues, how do we ever begin to talk about it? How do we confront a feeling or experience that, by its very nature, is something we don't want to talk about? Defining shame. These questions point to the absolute power of shame. Shame is an emotion that we have all felt, yet when we try to describe it, when we try to make it accessible for other people to understand, we struggle to find the words. Even when we find the words, it is rare that people will want to listen. Experiencing shame is painful. Just listening to someone share a shaming experience can be almost as painful. I quickly came to believe that the first step in understanding shame is developing a shared vocabulary to communicate our experiences. Therefore, my first goal was to develop a definition of shame. When I asked the research participants to define shame for me, they either gave me their personal definition or they shared an experience as an example. Here are some of their definitions. Shame is that feeling in the pit of your stomach that is dark and hurts like hell. You can't talk about it and can't articulate how bad it feels because then everyone would know your dirty little secret. Shame is being rejected. You work hard to show the world what it wants to see. Shame happens when your mask is pulled off and the unlikable parts of you are seen. It feels unbearable to be seen. Shame is feeling like an outsider, not belonging. Shame is hating yourself and understanding why other people hate you too. I think it's about self-loathing. Shame is like a prison, but a prison that you deserve to be in because something's wrong with you. Shame is being exposed. The flawed parts of yourself that you want to hide from everyone are revealed. You want to hide or die. You can see by these examples that it's virtually impossible to explain shame without evoking the incredibly powerful and overwhelming feelings associated with it. When I asked how shame feels, women used words like devastating, noxious, consuming, excruciating, filleted, small, stained, incredibly lonely, rejected, and the worst feeling ever. I often refer to shame as a full contact emotion. When we experience it, or even listen to a friend's story about a shaming experience, we often have a visceral and physical response. It's emotionally overwhelming, but we also feel it in our bodies. After hearing so many diverse yet related definitions, I realized that it would be helpful to have a simple definition that captures the emotion and meaning that I heard in the interviews. So I compiled the definitions, analyzed them, and developed this conceptual definition. Shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing we are flawed and therefore unworthy of acceptance and belonging. While the definition gives us a starting point, what really breathes life into our understanding of shame are the examples that women shared as they struggled to put words around the concept. Shame is my mom still being hateful about my weight. Every time I go home to visit with my husband and kids, the first thing she says is, "My God, you're still fat." And the last thing she says when I walk out the door is, "Hopefully you can lose some weight." She screwed me up so bad already, you'd think she'd be over it by now, but no, she just keeps going. I don't hate having sex. I don't really enjoy it, but I don't totally hate it. I have 3 kids, and now that I have them, I don't even see the point in sex anymore. If I never had sex again, I'd be fine. And I know that's totally not normal. And it makes me feel very ashamed, like something is really wrong with me. I hate those articles that say the average married couple has sex 3 times a week. I'm thinking, geez, that's not me. And I feel a lot of shame about that because I really wouldn't care if I never had it again. It's bad because I know my husband doesn't feel like that. He could be one of those people having it 3 or 4 times a week. When I was in high school, my mom committed suicide. She hung herself in her bedroom in our house. The neighborhood constable found her. From that day forward, I was the girl whose mom hung herself. It was the worst imaginable thing in my life. My dad forced me to finish high school there, but I've never gone back. My dad died a couple of years ago, and in some ways I was relieved because I never wanted to see or go back to that neighborhood again. It's funny because I think if my mom would have died of cancer or something else, people would have been more understanding. People wouldn't have been so cruel, but when it's suicide, it's completely different. My mother was the crazy lady who hung herself, so that means I must be crazy too. I even think that some of my friends' parents were scared of me and my dad. That's shame. My oldest son is a drug addict. His younger brother and sister just despise him. When he comes home to stay for the weekend or visit, it's just always a horrible situation. My daughter always says, "Mom, hide all your nice stuff. Don't leave your purse on the table." Good God, they're talking about their brother. I guess I know they're right, but I don't know what I did. I don't know why this is happening, and I'm so ashamed of him, and I'm so ashamed of how we treat him. It's the hardest thing, I think, in our family right now. When I was in middle school, my aunt's boyfriend molested me. I told my older sister, and she told my parents. I don't remember exactly what they said, but they called me and my sister into the living room and told us that we shouldn't talk about it with anyone. My mom told me that she would deal with my aunt. I don't know what happened, but I never saw him again. My aunt never said anything about it to me. My sister was so pissed. She stayed mad at my parents for years. I just became a quiet person, ashamed and quiet. I think all of the body stuff is shaming. It's like you never get to see normal bodies, or you never get to read about what normal bodies do. I think you're always thinking, do other people's breasts look like this? Do other people get hair here and no hair there? Do other people smell like this? Does this look like this? Do you get pimples there? I think everything about your body that you don't see on the perfect people on TV or in the magazines, you wonder if you're the only person and you gross yourself out, and that's what shame is. Shame is when you're grossed out by yourself. It's when your very own body makes you sick. I'd like to see a book that has all the information, like, this is 20 ways this can smell, or this is a picture of 50 normal women's breasts, and here's what they can look like. Then you can be like, oh, okay, I'm normal. But you have to ask, who would pose for that? Probably not normal people. Then you'd be comparing yourself to crazy people. It's just ridiculous that no one is ever going to talk about the weird stuff out of the fear that they're actually the one person that has that. Then it's like, uh-oh. Then it's double worse because then you're ashamed. And you think you're supposed to be ashamed. 5 years ago, I quit my job, and my husband and I took out a second mortgage so I could start my own business. After 2 years, I had to shut down my online clothing store. It was devastating. You always hear about the people who give up everything to follow their dreams, and they are always very successful and happy. I'm in debt, in a terrible new job, and ashamed that I couldn't make it work. I got everyone around me excited and involved, then I failed. I'm ashamed of being a failure. When we were growing up, my sister and I used to fight all the time about which one of us was closest to my mom. And now we fight about who has to take care of my mom, or whose house she's going to stay in. It's like you look at yourself and you look at your children and you think, God, one day my kids are going to be fighting about who has to take care of me. And then you think, oh, it's going to be different for me. This is not going to happen to me. But you know, I remember my mom saying that too. And then you think, oh my God, what if she knew that we were arguing about who had to take her? I mean, that I don't know if my sister is ashamed, but I'm certainly ashamed about my struggle to deal with my mom. Infertility was shaming for me because it was a lonely feeling. I felt as if no one else could understand my pain, especially all those around me with children. You feel as if something is wrong with you, or that you are somehow being punished for something you've done wrong. You wonder in the back of your mind if this is somehow in the plan, because you are unfit to be a mother. My husband is a very successful business owner, a leader in our church, and a good husband and father. I know there's nothing seriously wrong with him, but I think he's addicted to adult websites. We never talk about it, and I certainly haven't told anyone but my sister. Her advice is not to worry about it. I just know he's on the computer very late at night, and we get lots of charges from the websites on our credit card. I didn't even know until I was checking our email for someone's address, and I saw emails from the porn sites. It was so disgusting. That's when I checked the credit card. If anyone found out, I would die. Not only would people think that he's a pervert, they'd think something is wrong with me. That somehow I'm to blame because he had to go to the internet for sex. I can't even talk to him about it. I would die of shame if anyone else found out. The pain in these stories is palpable. At the exact time that our society embraces shaming, blaming, judgment, and rejection, it also holds acceptance and belonging as immensely important. In other words, it's never been more impossible to fit in, yet fitting in has never been more important and valued. An early call for compassion. If this book is going to serve as a helpful tool on our journey to shame resilience, I think it's critical to acknowledge right from the start how difficult it is to read some of the stories in this book, how very painful it can be to just hear shame. When a friend or family member shares her or his shame story, or even when we read about a stranger's shame experience in a book. We often have one of two reactions. If we can relate to the story, because it's an issue that we face, the experience is often both painful and strangely comforting. The pain stems from being forced to think about an issue that we probably try to keep under the surface. The comfort comes from recognizing that we are not alone in our struggles. We aren't the only one. One reason shame is so powerful is its ability to make us feel alone. Like we are the only one, or somehow we're different from everyone else. When we hear stories that mirror our own shame experiences, it helps us know we aren't alone. Of course, if the story hits too close to home, we can actually find ourselves in the grip of shame. Rather than just listening and responding to someone else's experience, we become overwhelmed with our own feelings of shame. When we hear stories about shame that don't fit with our experiences, our first reaction is often to distance ourselves from the experiences. My mother would never say that, or, I don't get women who don't enjoy sex, or, she's so naive, her husband's a wacko. The distancing turns very quickly into blame, judgment, and separation. This fuels the shame epidemic. Let me give you an example of my own struggle to practice compassion. When I interviewed Allison, the young woman whose mother had committed suicide, I was appalled by the reaction of her friends, neighbors, and even teachers. During the months following her mother's death, she couldn't go anywhere without hearing whispers, experiencing the isolation of people intentionally avoiding her, or being confronted with inappropriate questions about the details of her mother's suicide. At first, Allison felt that the rejection was undeserved. She knew it wasn't her fault, and that her mother's mental illness was not a reflection on her. But as the whispering continued, she began to believe that somehow her mother's suicide meant she was also defective, her own word. This is when the shame started and left her feeling completely ostracized and alone. I stewed over this interview for a couple of weeks. I felt great compassion and empathy for Allison. However, I was mired in feelings of anger, judgment, and blame. I felt self-righteous anger toward those people who had lacked any sensitivity and treated her so unfairly. I spent days thinking about my reaction to her story until finally I was confronted by some hard truths. First of all, if we are going to understand shame, we must not only seek to understand Allison's experiences, but the reactions of those around her. We can't simply shift shame from Allison to her insensitive neighbors. Shaming her neighbors and friends would be equally destructive. Second, we have to dig deep and be honest about how we might react as a neighbor or friend. If I came home from work and saw an ambulance and police cars surrounding a neighbor's house, I'd immediately patch into the neighborhood phone tree to find out what happened. I might not walk over and stand around gawking because I'd like to believe I'm above that. Or at least I'd want my neighbors to think I'm above it. Instead, I'd call someone who had walked over, which is probably worse. Unless I was extremely aware of what I was doing and I was consciously working not to gossip, I would probably be equally guilty of talking about it, speculating why, wondering about the details, and drawing false conclusions. I can just hear conversations where we're saying things like, I knew something wasn't right over there, or, you know, one day I saw her. I might even make assumptions about the mental stability of Allison's father, or about Allison herself following such a traumatic event. I might become uncomfortable letting my daughter play at her house. In other words, I might become exactly what I hated, and at first, refused to understand. Why? Because I'm a terrible person like Allison's teachers, neighbors, and friends? No, it's because I'm human, and situations like that can throw us into our own fear, anxiety, grief, and sometimes even into our own shame. And to alleviate those overwhelming feelings, we seek connection with others, sometimes in incredibly hurtful and destructive ways, like gossiping and excluding others. If we really want to get at the heart of the beast, We have to understand more than what it feels like to experience shame. We need to understand when and why we are the most likely to engage in shaming behaviors toward others, how we can develop our resilience to shame, and how we can consciously make the effort not to shame others. Not all of the stories presented here will mirror our own experiences, but I suspect many will feel uncomfortably familiar. Our level of resilience to shame is not dependent solely on our ability to recognize these behaviors and emotions in ourselves, but also on our ability to build connections with others. These connections require us to understand what we share in common when it comes to shame. Shame 101. What do we need to know and understand in order to build resilience to shame? How do we connect with our authentic selves and build meaningful connections with others? Why, when it comes to the isolating emotion of shame, is there so much power and freedom in simply understanding the deep connections among all of our experiences? These are complex questions, and before we can answer them, we need to address some of the basics of shame. In this section, we will start to build an understanding of shame, including how it is different from guilt, humiliation, or embarrassment, and how shame operates in our lives. Once we have built this foundational understanding of shame, many of the connections that have been so elusive will begin to emerge and make sense in the context of our lives. Embarrassment, guilt, humiliation, and shame. One of the simpler reasons shame is so difficult to talk about is vocabulary. We often use the terms embarrassment, guilt, humiliation, and shame interchangeably. Without much thought, we whisper, "That was so humiliating." When we walk out of a restroom with toilet paper stuck to our shoe, or shout, "Shame on you," to a child who has unfortunately, but age-appropriately, colored on the table rather than in the coloring book. It might seem overly sensitive to stress the importance of using the appropriate term to describe an experience or emotion. However, it is much more than just semantics. Speaking shame, or being able to identify and label these emotions, is one of the four elements of shame resilience. Within the research community, there are interesting debates about the relationships between embarrassment, guilt, humiliation, and shame. Although there is a small group of researchers who believe that all four of these emotions are related and represent varying degrees of the same core emotion, the vast majority of researchers believe that the four are separate, distinct experiences. Like most of the studies on shame, my research strongly supports the argument that embarrassment, guilt, humiliation, and shame are four different emotional responses. Embarrassment is the least powerful of these emotions. Women described embarrassing situations as much less serious than either guilt or shame. Embarrassment is, by definition, something that is fleeting, often eventually funny, and very normal. For example, tripping, misspeaking, etc. Regardless of how embarrassing a situation might be, we know, or at least have heard, that it happens to other people and we know it will go away. I don't want to walk out of the bathroom with toilet paper on my shoe, but if I do, I know I'm not the first or only one to have done it. Guilt is probably the term most often confused with shame. And unfortunately, the effects of this confusion transcend semantics and term confusion. Often when we try to shame others or ourselves into changing a behavior, we do so without understanding the differences between shame and guilt. This is important because guilt can often be a positive motivator of change, while shame typically leads to worse behavior or paralysis. Here's why. Guilt and shame are both emotions of self-evaluation. However, that is where the similarities end. The majority of shame researchers agree that the difference between shame and guilt is best understood as the differences between "I am bad," shame, and "I did something bad," guilt. Shame is about who we are, and guilt is about our behaviors. If I feel guilty for cheating on a test, my self-talk might sound something like, "I should not have done that. That was really stupid. Cheating is not something I believe in or want to do. If I feel shame about cheating on a test, my self-talk is more likely to sound like, I'm a liar and a cheat. I'm so stupid. I'm a bad person. Guilt is holding an action or behavior up against our ethics, values, and beliefs.